Disculpen, vamos a empezar nuevamente. Se declara abierta la novena sesión del noveno periodo de sesiones del Foro Permanente para las Cuestiones Indígenas. Distinguidos miembros del Foro, el Foro Permanente examinará esta mañana el tema 7 de su programa, titulado La labor futura del Foro Permanente, incluidas cuestiones relacionadas con el Consejo Económico y Social y nuevas cuestiones. Tendremos presentación y debate de los informes siguientes: estudios sobre las consecuencias de la crisis económica mundial para los pueblos indígenas, informe sobre los pueblos indígenas y las empresas transnacionales. En su noveno periodo de sesiones, el foro debatirá una serie de estudios elaborados este año por el Foro Permanente de las Naciones Unidas para las Cuestiones Indígenas. Además de estos informes, vamos a tratar informes relativos al reconocimiento de los derechos de la Madre Tierra y, por último, tendremos el reporte del Grupo de Expertos sobre Niños y Adolescentes en Situación de Detención. En la sesión de hoy examinaremos el estudio sobre las consecuencias de la crisis económica mundial para los pueblos indígenas. La señora Victoria Tauli Corpus presentará los resultados de este estudio. Doy la palabra a la señora Tauli Corpus.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to everybody. This report is, I would like to first say that there is not a written submitted report on this yet because it's still a work in progress, but I will just present some of the initial results of the study that has been made with the hope that it will be completed before the session ends. During the 8th session of the Permanent Forum, a decision was made for the preparation of a report on the impacts of the global economic crisis on indigenous peoples. And I was appointed to conduct a study on the impacts of the global economic crisis on indigenous peoples to identify measures and proposals for governments and the United Nations bodies, agencies, funds, and programs to address the impacts and to report thereon to the forum at its 9th session in 2010. This global financial and economic crisis and its social, economic, and environmental costs have been analyzed by numerous experts and by some UN bodies such as the General Assembly, DESA, and agencies like the ILO, WHO, UNESCO, among others, as well as commissions and conferences set up by the UN and other multilateral bodies. These studies and reports analyze the origins of the crisis, look into the situation of workers, the impacts on health and education, and the impacts on development, among others. However, not much has been written on the impacts of indigenous peoples. So this report will try to consolidate the various scattered reports on how indigenous peoples are affected and what their short and long-term challenges are in terms of addressing this impact. It will also link the special theme with the special theme of the forum, which is indigenous peoples development with culture and identity. The concluding section will discuss measures and proposals on how these impacts can be addressed. The financial crisis, which was triggered by widespread speculative lending and investment in major financial centers, has now led to the global economic crisis. When the subprime mortgage crisis struck the USA in 2007, which was characterized by bank runs and the collapse of major financial institutions like Lehman Brothers, it was inevitable that the real economy in both the U.S. and other countries who export to the U.S. will be adversely affected. We are now witnessing the most severe global recession since the 1930s. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate on economics, concluded that, and I quote, "This is not only the worst global economic downturn of the post-World War II era, it is the first serious global downturn of the modern era of globalization. America's financial markets failed to do what they should have done, manage risk and allocate capital well. And these failures have had major impacts all over the world. Globalization, too, did not work the way it was supposed to. It helped spread the consequences of the failures of U.S. financial markets around the world. September 11, 2001, taught us that with globalization, not only do good things travel more easily across borders, bad things do, too. September 15, 2008 has reinforced that lesson," unquote. In 2009, the Commission of Experts of the President of the General Assembly on Reforms of the International Monetary and Financial System, which is more popularly known as the Stiglitz Commission, was established. The Commission analyzed the origins and trajectories of this crisis. And they said, I quote, "The current financial crisis, which began in the United States, then spread to Europe, has now become global. The rapid spread of the financial crisis from a small number of developed countries to engulf the global economy provides tangible evidence that the international trade and financial system needs to be profoundly reformed to meet the needs and change conditions of the early 21st century. The crisis has exposed fundamental problems not only in national regulatory systems affecting finance, competition, and corporate governance, but also in international institutions and arrangements created to ensure financial and economic stability. These institutions have proven unable to prevent the crisis and have been slow to design and implement adequate responses. Indeed, some policies recommended by these institutions have facilitated the spread of the crisis around the world." Unquote. A common conclusion in these various reports is that the theory of self-correcting and efficient markets is debunked by this crisis. It is not just a result of a temporary malfunctioning or aberration of the economic growth model, but a clear failure on its own terms. Its promise of endless stable growth and increasing volumes for most people has not come about. Instead, we have witnessed gross inequities, volatility, and ecological degradation. The New Economics Foundation, a respected think tank based in the United Kingdom, said that, and I quote, "These are not anomalies, but a natural and increasingly severe expression of the normal functioning of the system." Similar conclusions were contained in the Stiglitz Commission report, which says that the present crisis demonstrates failure at many levels of theory and philosophy, of institutions, policies and practices, and less overtly of ethics and accountability. According to Miguel Discoto, the General Assembly President, in his foreword to the report of the Commission, he said, "These crises are not results of a failure or failures of the system. Rather, the system itself, its organization and principles, and its distorted and flawed institutional mechanisms is the cause of many of these failures." While there are claims that the world is overcoming this crisis, evidences show that most countries, both developed and developing, are still undergoing economic decline, and economic recovery is far from being reached. Yield must accuse an economist who has looked deeply into this crisis, said that the combination of sharply declining commodity and manufacturing export earnings, collapse of remittances, reversal of private capital flows, rising risk spreads, an extreme degree of credit squeeze affecting even trade finance and losses of asset values is giving rise to a sharp economic downturn and even contraction in many parts of the developing world. Despite the massive bailout, operations through the infusion of capital into weakened financial institutions and industrial firms, there is not much to show in terms of economic recovery. For many indigenous peoples, they view this global economic and financial crisis as just one side of the coin. The other side is the global ecological crisis of biodiversity loss, resource depletion, such as peak oil, and climate change. This situation the world faces now is clearly the direct result of the economic growth model, which promotes unfettered markets, export orientation, debt dependency, overconsumption, and overproduction. The Secretary General's report and the Division for Sustainable Development Trends report on sustainable consumption and production concludes that absolute consumption of resources has continued to increase with population, and gross development product in both developed and developing countries. Development has exceeded the carrying capacity of ecosystems in various geographic areas, whether measured by the footprint analysis or by the number of endangered species, degraded ecosystems and land, deforestation, or decrease in fish stocks. It is also clear that social inequalities are not being reduced with growth and globalization. In terms of social and economic, environmental, and cultural impacts, there are both adverse and positive impacts for indigenous peoples in both developed and developing countries. The extent of the impact depends on how the economies of the countries where indigenous peoples live are integrated with the global economy. Most countries are exporting primary commodities and semi-manufactured and manufactured goods to the USA and Europe and other OECD countries. As well, overseas contract workers go to the rich countries as well as countries in the Middle East and in Korea and other emerging economies. It was surmised earlier that the Asian countries will not be affected because they can decouple their economies from the USA. This was wishful thinking, however, because most economies of Asian countries were shaped to be export-oriented and debt-dependent, and liberalization policies were imposed and adopted by most countries. So we can see direct impacts on these countries as well as on indigenous peoples living in these countries. I would like to focus more on the USA because this is where the crisis has started, and I would like to look at some of the social and economic impacts on Native Americans, which are very direct. To begin with, the level of poverty amongst the Native Americans are already disproportionately high compared to the average American. The Harvard Project on the American Indian Development has documented that between 1990 and 2000, the poverty rate for Native Americans was more than two times the average for all Americans, and the unemployment rate twice as high. Cyclical and growing unemployment, rising energy bills and gas prices, and skyrocketing cost of food, housing, healthcare, and other necessities has plagued many Indians for generations. However, the current recession has worsened this situation many times over. This recession has diverse impacts on 360 historically impoverished American Indian tribes in the lower 48 states and has created an even larger gap between Native America's haves and have-nots. Several hearings were conducted in the Senate on the situation of Native Americans after the 2008 financial crisis, and these showed the diverse impacts. The gaming industry, for instance, has declined significantly as there are less people going to the casinos due to the crisis. It was reported that there is a drop of 9% and more in gaming revenues, which has affected 60 or 70 tribes with lucrative casinos, mainly with small populations and located in metropolitan areas. Massive layoffs of Indians has taken place in most of these casino gaming operations. The Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut, for example, had steady growth every year since it opened in 1996. In 2008, however, its slot machine revenues dropped, which led to a slowdown, and the casino cut the salaries of all 9,800 employees, of which some are Indians. There are almost 300 larger and more remote tribes in the Great Plains, Upper Midwest, and Southwest United States, some with marginal gaming operations and others with no casinos, whose poverty levels have significantly increased. It has to be noted in the first place that casinos do not meet all of the community needs in Indian country. Since the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed in 1988, the gaming industry was established in various reservations, and this has provided employment to a significant population of Native Americans living on those reservations, and the revenue generated has supported many tribal government programs. However, out of the 561 federally recognized tribes, less than half of these are involved in gaming operations. Of the 367 tribal gaming facilities, the top 4% in terms of revenue generated more than 37% of all the revenues. Besides, data from the National Indian Gaming Association says that out of 670,000 Indian casino jobs, non-Indians hold 75% of these. One of the hardest hit sectors where Indians are employed is the timber industry. Because of the housing crisis, there is not much demand for timber. And based on the census three-year average from 2005 to 2007, natives are predominantly employed in the construction, extraction, maintenance, and repair sectors, with a full one-fourth of single-race male Indian workers working in these fields. These industries also comprise a substantial proportion of American Indian businesses. In 2002, nearly 3 in 10 American Indian-owned businesses were in these sectors, and 41%, which is amounting to $11 billion of Native American-owned business revenues, come from construction and retail trade. As with the timber industry, the construction industry has been hurt by the precipitous decline in housing markets that started with the recession we are currently facing. Ms. Jacqueline Pata, Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, revealed that unemployment rate soared between 50 to 90% during the recession. Unemployment in the Navajo Nation is reported to range from 50 to 55%. 8 of the 10 poorest countries in the United States are on reservations. The Wind River Reservation is located on 2.2 million hectares in central Wyoming, has an unemployment rate which exceeds 70%, and over 60% of the households live below the poverty line. With the 2008 recession, these statistics show even worse averages, not only for the national workforce, but for the Indian workforce. In the light of this data, I would like to just cite one more data. One of the data is the impact on health and the suicide rates. The rate of suicide among American Indian and Alaska Natives is 70% higher than the general U.S. population. data shows that the 10 states with the highest percentage of Indians almost coincide with the 10 states with highest rates of youth suicide. Reports also show that indigenous women in Indian country are disproportionately affected by the crisis. The Indian Health Services unit at Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation released an alarming statistic which shows that the suicide rate among the Sioux Indians is 200 per 100,000 for males ages between 15 to 24. This makes Rosebud the epicenter of suicide as it has the highest suicide rate in the world. In light of this data, the announcement of Ambassador Rice of the position of the U.S. government to review its position on the UN Declaration is very much welcome. This can be a major step towards the better resolution of the situation of Native Americans. It is my hope that this review will lead towards a change of position towards the endorsement by the U.S. of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Let me now briefly turn to the other regions of the world. I come from the Philippines, and I can speak of the situation of indigenous peoples in my country. In the region where I come from, the Cordillera region, the impact of the recession is very much felt. In the city where I live, there are several factories like the Texas Instrument, which has been there since the export processing zone was established in the 70s. Now it has retrenched almost 400 workers, many of whom are indigenous persons, and the exports of semi-processed conductors and microchips have decreased due to the crisis, which has resulted in this. The situation in Southeast Asia has shown the rate of GDP growth has dropped from 6.5% in 2007 to 4.3% in 2008. But it is expected to plummet further to 1.5% in 2009. This has serious consequences for indigenous peoples because the levels of unemployment has likewise increased. Remittances of overseas workers contribute significantly to the gross domestic product of many developing countries. This is the case in my country as well as other Asian, Pacific, Latin American and African countries. Among these, overseas workers or migrants are the ones who are suffering from the impact. The effect of the financial crisis was not only limited to economic and financial indicators, but especially to key social indicators. In the Philippines, company closures, bankruptcy, and constant layoffs were greatly affected, has greatly affected the labor sector. The influx of overseas Filipino workers coming home was a result of companies that were badly affected by the crisis. The range of industries affected include electronic, metalwork, semiconductor, shipbuilding, telecommunication, advertising, information technology, hotel, extractive oil and gas, garments, and cruise vessel businesses. This is the same case with indigenous peoples from Latin America, such as Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, among others, and also in the Pacific. Tonga is an example where remittances contribute between 55 to 60% of gross domestic product, and the decrease in remittances has resulted to stresses, especially for women in their daily role as caregivers, protectors, and providers. Many indigenous territories are also earning from tourism, which has been seriously affected by the crisis. Fiji's response to the crisis, which is compounded by decrease on tourism, is bringing down the retirement age for public servants to 55. In Thailand, where tourism is the major source of income, the hill tribe people, who are also dependent on tourism-related livelihoods, are also affected. These declining commodity prices also as a result of this recession has negatively affected Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia, which stand to lose significantly. Exports have declined by 25% in Indonesia, 13% in Malaysia, and 32% in Vietnam. The downturn also hits farmers in food-exporting countries such as Thailand and Vietnam, and government revenues in oil-exporting ASEAN members such as Malaysia. The loss of income of indigenous farmers who are engaged in cash crop production and the increase of food commodity prices for food importing countries like the Philippines has led to food insecurity amongst indigenous peoples. I can go on and cite other cases in Africa and other regions, but I won't consume the time. So I would just like to mention also some of the positive impacts. Actually, in the Extractive Industries Conference that we held in the Philippines, one of the positive impacts which was cited by indigenous peoples is the decrease in mining exploitation in many of their territories because there are no investments coming into the countries to push for this exploitation. Therefore, there has been a break in some countries where the fight for indigenous peoples to have their rights to their lands be recognized and to fight against the entry of mining corporations without their consent has really been a welcome break for them. The other positive impact, of course, is in relation to also the issue of tourism. For many indigenous territories where tourism is a big industry, they have also mentioned that with the crisis, they are not now subjected to the influx of some of the unwanted tourists, especially those tourists who go to their communities for like pedophiles and other undesirable tourists who usually are seen in their own communities. So it's not as if the crisis has just a negative impact. It has also positive impacts. Of course, in the issue of environment, because there has been a decrease in industrial operations as well as extractive operations, even the Climate Change Convention has acknowledged that there is now a decrease in the increase of greenhouse gas emissions precisely because the production has really slowed down significantly. So maybe for the environment, there are some positive impacts. Now let me just end with some of the recommendations that are coming from many of the documents which I read. The first recommendation is in relation to the stimulus packages that are being given by the rich countries like here in the United States. When President Obama met with the American Indians and talked about the issues of Indians, he committed that economic stimulus will be provided to the Native Americans to address the issue of crisis. And I think many of the American Indians have presented their proposals in terms of how these stimulus packages be used. And what has come out in some of the documents I read is that they would like to use the stimulus packages to really redesign the kind of development that's happening in their communities so that they will not replicate the same kind of development which has led to this kind of crisis that we see now. They are wanting to recover their values and their tribal systems that are more friendly, not only among themselves, that are more in consonance with their cultures and identities, but are also more sustainable. So these are just some of the things that they are recommending, that in these stimulus packages, they should be involved in designing where these stimulus packages are going to be used, how they are going to be designed, and they should be the direct beneficiaries of such stimulus packages. The other recommendation is increasing the safety nets. Obviously, with all these impacts of the crisis, there is a need to increase the safety nets for indigenous peoples to be able to adapt to the crisis that has been caused by this economic and financial crisis. So they are suggesting that safety nets should likewise be designed and put in place so that they will be able to withstand, they will be able to last the impacts of this crisis. The third point is the issue of ensuring that rights and accountability mechanisms are also being put in place. And they have this was mentioned because there has been some issues raised in relation to putting stimulus packages or the World Bank increasing its investment or its loans for infrastructures to stimulate the economies of the developing countries. And fear has been communicated in terms of how fast these infrastructure projects are going to be done and whether the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples are going to be obtained before these projects are coming to their communities. There's also a call to increase the accountability mechanisms, both of states as well as of international intergovernmental organizations. Finally, there also are proposals that the national institutions should be strengthened to enhance a more inclusive macroeconomic environment and to change the macroeconomic policies of governments to be inclusive of indigenous peoples and indigenous peoples' economies as well as ecosystems. The last point I would like to say is that this crisis is both a risk, it's both a problem, but it's really an opportunity also for indigenous peoples, because many of the dominant economic theories of economic development are now strongly being challenged. It's an opportunity for indigenous peoples to bring into the fore their own economic thinking, the ways they think of their own self-determined economic development and social and political development, as well as their ecosystems approach to development. So I think indigenous peoples should be supported by the Permanent Forum as well as the UN agencies and by states to be able to realize their own self-determined development, because this is the kind of development that can really promote more sustainability and less possibilities of creating more crises in the future. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias, señora Tauli, por su informe. Ciertamente que, como usted acaba de decir, la crisis económica es una oportunidad para los pueblos indígenas, y esa oportunidad creo que lo hemos aprovechado muy bien, presentando como una propuesta desde los pueblos indígenas modelos propios, como es el vivir bien, que tiene una resonancia mundial y expresa nuestra relación tan especial que tenemos con la Madre Tierra. Creo que es una excelente propuesta que en conjunto estamos haciendo. A continuación procederemos a examinar la siguiente parte del tema 7 del programa, a saber, el informe sobre los pueblos indígenas y las empresas transnacionales. Presentarán este informe los miembros del foro permanente, la señora Elisa Kanki, el señor Pavel Zuliansiga y luego mi persona. Señora Kanki, usted tiene la palabra. Vamos a esperar entonces a que se incorpore nuestro colega Pavel Zuliansiga y daremos paso al reporte del estudio sobre la armonización con la Madre Tierra. Damos la palabra al señor Bartolomé Clavero, que también
si no están listos.
Tenemos un pequeño problema, entonces, colegas, no estamos listos. Esta tarde haremos. Vamos a pasar al reporte del grupo de expertos sobre niños y jóvenes indígenas en situación de detención. Para esto ofreceremos primero la palabra a nuestra colega Tonia Gonella Frichner, y luego, señora Tonia, por favor, estaba diciendo que vamos a dar lectura al reporte del grupo de expertos sobre niños y jóvenes indígenas. Daremos a usted primero la palabra y luego hará el informe del reporte la señora, ¿cómo se llama?
Andrea Carmen.
La señora Andrea Carmen. Entonces, por favor, señora Tonia Gonella.
gracias.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and warm greetings to you and to all the colleagues in the room this morning. I have the privilege of introducing the report of the International Expert Group meeting on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption. Mr. Chairman, in 2008, the son of one of our human rights experts, who we lost in 1999, Ingrid Washinawatuk, brought forward a recommendation to the Permanent Forum about his concern of children and youth in detention and custody throughout North America, and asked the Permanent Forum to look at this particular issue. And at that time, I had the privilege of sitting in the chairperson seat just temporarily at that moment while our chair, Vicky, had another assignment. And it was a momentous occasion to watch someone from a young man, a child turned into a young man making this incredible intervention. Members of the North American Caucus took this resolution very seriously and brought it forward in 2009. And with the support of the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, as well as the Permanent Forum, developed an expert group meeting with the leadership of Grand Chief Ed John, who unfortunately is not with us today, Andrea Carmen, Celeste McKay, and many other people from North America. And there was a meeting hosted by a wonderful community, the Tlaxcala Huatuth, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize, Nation in British Columbia, Canada. They were just wonderful hosts. And what I would like to note before Ms. Carmen takes the floor, Mr. Chairman, is that the report last year of the permanent session included a strong recommendation to the Economic and Social Council to urge the governments ensure protection of children and youth while in detention and provide them with rehabilitation. This was something I brought forward at the meeting, and what I also stated at the expert group meeting was that the Permanent Forum encouraged governments, UN, and intergovernmental agencies and NGOs to collect and distribute disaggregated data on Indigenous children and youth in state detention. What the experts looked at this meeting was they took a human rights framework for this meeting and they presented it based on key international norms and standards, including the preambular paragraph of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which states, if I may quote, "recognizing in particular the right of Indigenous families and communities to retain shared responsibility for the upbringing, training, education, and well-being of their children, consistent with the well-being and rights of the child." Mr. Chairman, during our deliberation, I would like to note that we looked very carefully at the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978 that is a federal law of the United States. And we found that the United States was the only government in the world that had a federal law protecting its native children. And I just wanted to bring that forward to the chair. Mr. Chairman, it is my privilege to ask Andrea Carmen to bring forward the report of this excellent meeting. So I'll introduce Ms. Andrea Carmen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted, señora Carmen.
Well, Madam Vice Chair, for your important words of introduction and background for the presentation of this UN Expert Group Meeting, EGM, report on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption. The EGM was held March 4th to 5th, 2010, co-hosted by the UN Forum on Indigenous Issues and the Tsleil-Waututh Nation of British Columbia, Canada. EGM Chair Grand Chief Edward John is unable to join us today, so I am presenting this oral summary report as the EGM's rapporteur. The official EGM report is posted in its entirety on the Permanent Forum 9th Session website as e-c.19/2010/crp.8. I am very gratified to report to this session of the UN Permanent Forum on the very positive results of this EGM, which was attended by Indigenous experts from the Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, Russian Federation, Central Asia, and Transcaucasia, North America, and Pacific regions, as well as independent experts and representatives from the Permanent Forum, the UN Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, CERD, the UN Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, and the Organization of American States. Chiefs, elders, and community members of Indigenous nations from British Columbia and other regions of Canada, as well as representatives of the Canadian federal and British Columbia provincial governments, also attended as observers. Hereditary Frog Clan Grand Chief Edward John welcomed the experts and other participants. He also underscored that 50% of the children in government care in British Columbia, foster care and detention, are Aboriginal. And in the northern part of the province, it is close to 75% Indigenous children. United Nations Permanent Forum member Tanya Gonella Frischner noted that the report of the Permanent Forum's second session included a strong recommendation to ECOSOC to urge that governments ensure protection of children and youth while in detention and provide them with rehabilitation. She stated that the Permanent Forum can also encourage governments, UN and intergovernmental agencies, and NGOs to collect and distribute disaggregated data on Indigenous children and youth in state detention. A human rights framework for the EGM was presented based on key international norms and standards, including the preambular paragraph of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, to which Ms. Gonella Frischner just referred. This framework also included a number of other provisions of the UN Declaration, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and in particular its General Comment 11 from 2009, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and ILO Convention 169. These affirm a range of relevant rights in the following areas. 1, the rights of Indigenous children and youth to be Indigenous and to continue to be part of their own nations, communities, families, and cultures. 2, the inherent and inalienable rights of Indigenous peoples to self-determination and autonomy, self-government, free prior informed consent, full participation in all levels and areas of decision-making, the right to maintain, preserve, use, and transmit their cultures to future generations, and the right to maintain the integrity and well-being of their families, communities, and nations. It also included the obligations of states to uphold and respect their international human rights commitments, including those rights affirmed in international human rights instruments, as well as those affirmed in nation-to-nation treaties concluded with Indigenous nations. Indigenous experts spoke under the agenda items detention and custody, adoption, foster care, and causes, prevention, and healing the sacred hoop of our families and children. They addressed the continued legacy of removal policies in states such as the United States, Canada, and Australia, high rates of out-of-country adoptions from states such as Guatemala, and concerns regarding Indigenous children held in immigration detention facilities were also addressed. Several experts addressed the criminalization of activities which children and youth in extreme poverty use for survival, and ongoing impacts of economic marginalization and racial discrimination in many states. Experts consistently stressed the need to ensure direct involvement by Indigenous families and communities in decision-making about care and placement of their children, and the importance of culturally and spiritually based programs developed and implemented by and for Indigenous peoples, including support services for parents and extended families to enable children to remain in their care and custody. Summaries of all presentations by the experts are contained in the full report, which will be available in Spanish and French, in addition to English, in the coming months. The International Expert Group meeting adopted by consensus a number of conclusions and recommendations. These included, 1. Experts agreed that Indigenous children and youth are the basis for our survival as peoples. Their care, well-being, and integral development are our fundamental and sacred responsibilities in keeping with our traditional cultural principles and systems. 2. Experts recognized and welcomed the commitment of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in advancing the rights, survival, dignity, and well-being of Indigenous children as a priority focus of its work. 3. Experts agreed that existing human rights instruments form the international framework required addressing these issues using a rights-based approach. What is lacking is implementation. 4. Experts recognize the legacy and ongoing impacts of past removal policies and systems, such as the residential school system in Canada and the Stolen Generations in Australia, which were intended to produce assimilation and cultural destruction and resulted in all forms of abuse. These experiences continue to have serious and detrimental intergenerational impacts on the health and strength of Indigenous families and communities in the countries where they were practiced. 5. Experts agreed that discrimination, economic inequities, and racially discriminatory policies and practices continue to play a major role in the disproportionate placement of Indigenous children and youth in detention, foster care, custody, and adoption in many countries. 6. Experts noted the disproportionately high numbers of Indigenous youth in criminal system detention in many states compared to the rest of the population. 7. Indigenous young people are often criminalized by what are actually violations of states of their human rights obligations. These include racial discrimination, enforced poverty, economic marginalization, failure to protect children from all forms of abuse, including sexual abuse, treaty violations, and denial of access to traditional lands, resources, economic and subsistence activities. 8. Experts affirm the essential need to ensure full engagement and effective participation by Indigenous communities in designing preventative care, support services for at-risk families, children, and youth, as well as alternative placement options if required. Experts agreed that the lack of consistent disaggregated data on numbers of Indigenous children in various forms of state custody and detention presents ongoing challenges. Reliable data collection and assessment on such matters remains sporadic and selective, and in some cases, and in some states, it is non-existent. And 10, experts recognize good practices representing, in some cases, collaborative approaches undertaken by Indigenous peoples and states. These include the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, the Saskatchewan Justice Commission, Treaty 6 Declaration on Child and Family Wellness, Erminskin Cree Nation Constitution, the work of the federal agency PANI in Costa Rica in collaboration with Indigenous communities, the Indian Child Welfare Act in the United States, although failures in its implementation were also noted, the draft charter of the rights of the Maori child in Aotearoa, New Zealand, among others. as well as various programs carried out by Indigenous peoples with or without state support to bring spiritual and cultural practices for rehabilitation of incarcerated Indigenous youth, as well as for family restoration and healing in the U.S., Aotearoa, and other regions. A number of specific recommendations to conclude were agreed to by consensus of the experts to present at this session of the UN Permanent Forum. Those specifically addressing the future work of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which we hope will be taken into account by this session, include 1. Experts reiterate their call upon states to include the rights of Indigenous children and youth as a subject area in all their reports to UN human rights bodies. In particular, experts urge the UN Permanent Forum to monitor the implementation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, General Comment 11, called Indigenous Children and Their Rights under the Convention of 2009, through state parties' reports to UN treaty monitoring bodies and the Universal Periodic Review process. 2. Experts strongly urge the UN Permanent Forum to call upon states to comply with CRC General Comment 11 in the interpretation of their obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child. 3. Experts request that the Permanent Forum present this EGM report to the Interagency Support Group and urge the group to pay close attention to the conclusions and recommendations which directly pertain to the work of their respective agencies. Further, the Interagency Support Group members be encouraged to implement the recommendations in CRC General Comment 11 within their respective mandates. 4. Experts recommend that the UN Permanent Forum develop an inventory of UN instruments in addition to the CRC to determine whether there is an opportunity to participate in the development of other general comments similar to and building upon CRC General Comment 11 that can have a positive impact on the rights of Indigenous youth and children and on the role of Indigenous peoples in protecting their rights. 5. Experts strongly encourage states to fully implement all human rights instruments that defend the rights of the child. Experts further call upon the UN Permanent Forum to encourage the United States to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as only one of two states which have not yet done so, and to encourage all states to address the rights of the child and Indigenous children in all forms of state custody when they are reviewed by the Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review process. 6. Experts urge the Permanent Forum to encourage all regional human rights systems to fully recognize the legal systems and traditional government structures of Indigenous peoples in these regions. 7. Experts urge the Permanent Forum to request a report to its 10th session in 2011 on the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal on First Nation Child Welfare, filed by First Nations Child and Family Caring Center of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations. 8. Experts encourage Indigenous peoples to develop and restore their own healing and restoration models based on traditional concepts, practices, stories, songs, ceremonies, languages, worldviews, family and clan relationships, and to assess their effectiveness based on their own criteria and indicators for success. We call upon the Permanent Forum to compile and share these models with the agreement of the Indigenous peoples. While we also call upon states to recognize and support these traditional Indigenous models, we also strongly affirm that in no way does their validity and effectiveness depend on such recognition and support. 9. Experts call upon the Permanent Forum to urge states to promote special considerations for Indigenous children and youth in custody in keeping with the recommendations presented in this report and to submit reports on good practices as well as measures taken to address bad or inadequate practices and situations. Further experts request that states include updates on their implementation of existing international human rights standards in this regard to the permanent forum, including relevant provisions of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. 10. Experts request that the permanent forum call upon the Committee on the Rights of the Child, in keeping with Article 45C of the CRC, to request that the UN Secretary General conduct a study on the situation of the rights of Indigenous children, including the issues addressed in this EGM report, and addressing the need to collect and distribute relevant disaggregated data. And finally, 11, experts urge the permanent forum to conduct a follow-up seminar to monitor the implementation of the recommendations of the EGM and document additional good practices, solutions, and lessons learned in 2011 or 2012 prior to the 11th session of the UN Permanent Forum. In closing, we once again thank everyone involved in the implementation of this very important and productive expert group meeting, in particular the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the host nation, and the participating Indigenous experts. We ask the UN Permanent Forum to give close consideration to these recommendations and to include them in its report for this session, as well as in the development of its plans for future work. For all our relations, Shioque Otesia.
Muchas gracias, señora Tonia Gonella Frechner y la señora Andrea Carmen por este excelente reporte del grupo de expertos sobre niños y jóvenes en situación de detención. A continuación daremos la palabra a los colegas Paymane Haste y Hassan Id Belkassam para que nos hagan la exposición del estudio para determinar si las políticas y proyectos relativos al cambio climático se ajustan a las normas de la Declaración sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas. Señor Belkassam tiene la palabra.
استماعيت معزوف لون. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The study on the extent to which climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards set forth in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. At its seventh session, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues appointed Paimani Hasti and me as members of the Permanent Forums as a special rapporteurs to undertake a study to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. At the eighth session of the Permanent Forum, Ms. Hasti and me presented a concept paper outlining of the framework for the study. We were of the view that the impact of climate change mitigation measures on indigenous peoples on their land and on their land, territories, and resources highlights the extent to which climate change threatens indigenous peoples, particularly since the participation of indigenous peoples in climate change law and policies remains deficient. This study contains six parts on climate change, international climate change law and policy, climate change and indigenous peoples, climate change and human rights, the obligation to comply with the declaration, climate change and indigenous peoples' rights. The first part, climate change. The definition of climate change under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is a change of climate which is attributed directly or indirectly to human activity that alters the composition of the global atmosphere and which is in addition to natural climate variability observed over comparable time periods. Climate change is mainly caused by greenhouse gases emissions, owing largely to the increase in the combustion of fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change posits that cause the temperature of temperature rise include human activity, including power generation, deforestation, transport, agriculture, and industry. Existence and project changes as a result of climate change include contraction of snow-covered areas and sea ice, sea level rise and higher water temperatures, increased frequency of hot extremes, heavy precipitation events and increase in area affected by drought, increased intensity of tropical cyclones. The second part, international climate change law and policy. The Framework Convention, agreed in 1992, provides the framework for the international response to climate change. It does not set out specific obligation and strategies which are to be addressed under subsequent agreement. It aims to stabilize greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere at a level that will prevent dangerous interference with the climate system. Article 2. The Framework Convention has been ratified by 192 states. International climate change law and policy revolves around the twin strategy of mitigation, a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, and adaptation, an increase in the capacity to adapt to climate change. Under the Framework Convention Equity Principle, developed states as the principal producers of greenhouse gases historically and the most resource-rich are to carry a heavier burden in mitigation and adaptation strategies, including assisting to poorer countries and the development of technology. The Kyoto Protocol to the Framework Conventions detailed international climate change measures between 2008 and 2012, setting mandatory greenhouse gas emissions targets for developed states, establishing mechanism to achieve this, including carbon trading and the clean development mechanism, permitting developed states to achieve their emissions targets through investment in emission reduction in developing states, and developing monitoring, reporting, and verification measures. It is ratified by 190 states. In 2007, the parties of the Framework Convention adopted the Bali Action Plan, under which they were to reach agreement on at the end of the 15th session of the Conference of the Parties in 2009. Long-term emission reduction, mitigation, and adaptation strategies, technologies, transfer, and development and appropriate financing and investment. The 15th session of the Conference of the Parties to the Framework Convention did not reach a final agreement on all issues, nor on proposals for the reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation rate. deforestation and degradation has been estimated to contribute 18% of annual emissions of carbon dioxide. Although a RED agreement is close to being finalized. However, the majority of states agreed in the Copenhagen Accord, for example, that most developed states commit to implement emissions targets and provide resources. International climate change policy and law are highly politicized. The competing interests behind positions on climate change translate into numerous contentious issues such as contests over scientific assessment of severity and potentiality severity of climate change. Developed states are particularly concerned with the economic burden associated with responding to climate change. Developing states seek not to be hampered in their development by restriction on their use of energy, when developed states were not so hampered, seeking discrimination, but simultaneously see their interests align with measures to mitigate and adapt to climate change. The lowest carbon emitters with the greatest vulnerability to climate change impacts, including small Iceland developing states, are some of the states calling for strong commitments. Oil-producing states are concerned about the economic impact of lower oil use resulting from climate change mitigation measures. Consequently, climate change policy may be determined as much by political compromise as by the need to reduce the impact of climate change. A number of climate change mitigation and adaptation measures have been implemented already from bodies as diverse as the Global Environment Facilities, the World Bank, to the United Nations, to state development funds. These include the establishment of funds to implement and manage mitigation and adaptation strategies, carbon markets, emissions offset regimes, caps on carbon emissions, pilot trade mechanism, and so on. There are also a number of voluntary carbon offset measures being developed and implemented at the sub-states level, domestic regulatory regimes to address climate change vary. Now I would like to give the floor to my dear colleague, Paimani Hasti, to finish the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to all. Since this is my first time taking the floor, I like, Mr. Chairman, to congratulate you for your election. If I continue on the study that I participated along with Hassan, this part that I'm going to mention is the climate change and indigenous people and their rights. Climate change mitigation and adaptation measures can potentially have impact on indigenous people's rights. For example, RED policies can particularly affect indigenous peoples given they oftentimes inhabit forested areas. Their close relationship to forest as the environment that sustains them and their use and conservation of them. Numerous indigenous peoples participated in the COP15, and the reference to communities' engagement is included in the draft RED agreement. However, indigenous peoples continue to call for more comprehensive reference to dialogue that indigenous peoples' rights for all COP documents. The indigenous peoples' rights for participation, under that we did this study and assessment for climate change law and policy compliance with the declaration was suggested in this study. It must be borne in mind that some of the effects of climate change remain unknown, and climate change policy and law is evolving, making precise evaluation difficult for that. And indigenous people's right to participate in domestic and international climate change policy and law formation arises out of numerous declaration articles. If I can just mention the articles like 5, 3, 4, 5, 18, 19, 20, and I can continue to the 33 and 34. Indigenous people's rights to participate in decisions that affect them is set out in Article 18 in particular. Indigenous people's rights to participate is becoming stronger and stronger as climate change law and policy has more impacts on indigenous people's lives in more localized contexts. And a UN Red Commission report states that, and I quote, consultation with indigenous peoples as well as other stakeholders is necessary to maintain the legitimacy and transparency of a proposed national or subnational RED scheme, end of quote. In practice, however, indigenous peoples were not adequately consulted in the creation of UNFCCC or in Kyoto Protocol negotiations and have had to resort to protest to facilitate their appropriate inclusion while requests for more participation have been rejected. For the area of the self-determination, we should say that the climate change law and policies can support an indigenous people's right to self-determination. For example, RED funding goes directly to indigenous peoples. It could be viewed as recognizing the authority of indigenous peoples over their own lands, territories, and resources, in the case of forests, of course, and their self-determination, Conversely, if RED funding is channeled through the state and the state does not recognize indigenous peoples' authority over their forests, indigenous peoples' self-determination may be perceived to be undermined. The right to self-determination includes the right of indigenous peoples to freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. It is supported by Article 20, under which indigenous peoples are entitled to engage freely in all their traditional and other economic activities. And Article 23, which articulates indigenous peoples' right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for exercising their rights to development, entitling indigenous peoples to also utilize their resources for development. Thus, climate change law and policy attempting to limit indigenous peoples' use of their resources could undermine their right to self-determination if it is devised without indigenous peoples' participation and, where necessary, consent. The right for land, territories, and resources in this study talks about the climate change context, which securing indigenous peoples' ancestral lands, forests, waters, and resources, which provide the basis for sustainable local, social, economic, cultural, spiritual development. Diminishing indigenous peoples' land areas as a result of climate change, in the case of sinking islands and melting ice, highlight the need for international and domestic climate change and policy to aggressively mitigate the impact of climate change. In the interests of realizing the lands, territories, and resource rights in the declaration. The loss of these territories has a significant consequence for other rights also, such as indigenous peoples' traditional activities related to resources, including hunting and fishing. Indigenous peoples' land, territories, and resources are particularly vulnerable to climate change policies and laws, especially where land title remains to be vested in them or in otherwise are uncertain or challenged. Climate change policies to build dams and wind farms, to invest in trees, to plant for biofuel, for example, can all create incentives to deny recognition to indigenous people's lands and relocate them. And the right, under the right for to free prior and informed consent, FPIC, I should say the right to, the study says the right to FPIC is closely related to indigenous people's self-determination and other human rights obligations, especially the right to participation. It has been endorsed in numerous findings by, for example, the Human Rights Council, the Inter-American Human Rights Bodies, the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, the Third Committee, the Human Rights Committee, and the Permanent Forum. Overall, initiatives to seek indigenous peoples' FPIC must always be undertaken in good faith. Free means that indigenous peoples are under no coercion, intimidation, or manipulation. Prior means that consent must be sought sufficiently in advance of any authorization or commencement of activities, and that respect be shown for time requirements of indigenous consultation processes. It should include accurate information about the nature, size, and reversibility of any project, as well as its duration and an assessment of its necessity, and be presented in a manner appropriate for the indigenous peoples in question. Opportunities need to be provided for indigenous peoples to debate and deliberate on any proposal that might affect them. In raising with indigenous peoples, states must be careful to engage with bodies that represent the indigenous peoples affected and respect indigenous peoples' institutional and decision-making structures as required by the Declaration. The Declaration also requires the states in international settings, such as under the UNFCCC, to comply with the Declaration's free, prior, and informed consent provisions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Muchas gracias, señora Paimane Haste, y también el colega Hassan Belkassam. Ahora pasaremos a tratar el estudio sobre corporaciones y pueblos indígenas. Daremos la palabra a nuestro colega.
Viene en un momento.
Tell him that we're waiting for
Entonces,
viene en un momento.
There were some technical questions.
Hay algunas preguntas técnicas.
Questions.
Hay algunas técnicas, preguntas técnicas.
There was a question.
Tenemos alguna pequeña dificultad. Vamos a dar la palabra a los observadores a hacer preguntas sobre los estudios cuya lectura hemos escuchado. ¿Hay alguna pregunta entre los colegas y entre los observadores? Estamos refiriéndonos a los estudios expuestos acá por la colega. ¿Ah? Tiene la palabra usted.
Oui, Monsieur le Président. L'année dernière, dans le cadre de cette même instance et sous le même item, numéro 7, Travaux futurs, votre prédécesseur a remercié le FIDA de monter un atelier d'experts sur la contribution des peuples nomades au développement. J'ai interrogé le FIDA sur ce sujet et ils m'ont indiqué qu'en fait, ils attendaient de l'instance permanente le déclenchement de cet atelier d'experts. Une année s'est déroulée sans que rien n'ait été fait. Alors, il s'agissait en fait d'un atelier d'experts sur les peuples nomades de Mongolie. En tant que représentant d'organisations représentatives des peuples pastoraux, notamment de Touareg, je vous demande, la question c'est, est-ce que vous allez déclencher cet atelier d'experts? Bon, bien sûr pour la Mongolie. Et ensuite, comment est-ce que nous, on peut espérer que ce même atelier d'experts soit déclenché pour les peuples nomades de l'Afrique subsaharienne? Merci.
Gracias a usted por recordarnos esta recomendación. Vamos a dar la palabra a la Secretaría del Foro para hacernos un comentario sobre este tema.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And indeed, this was one of the recommendations from last year's session of the Permanent Forum, not to have a workshop just on the pastoral and people of Mongolia, but on pastoral people more generally of the world. And as participants know, it takes a little time before we are able to gather funds and to put something like that together. But this is definitely a recommendation of the forum that is alive and well, and the Secretariat has been in contact with agencies and governments in order for us to be able to carry out this workshop, and hopefully before the next session this will happen and there will be a report to the next session of the Permanent Forum. Thank you.
Gracias a la Secretaría. Abrimos nuevamente la posibilidad de que ustedes puedan plantear sus preguntas respecto a los dos estudios y el reporte sobre el grupo de expertos sobre niños y jóvenes en estado de tensión. Si hubiera alguna pregunta, entonces vamos a dar paso a la pregunta. No hay preguntas. Entonces, vamos a pasar a nuestra lista de oradores. Por favor, las personas que se han inscrito como oradores, ruego tomar atención. La primera oradora de nuestra lista es la señora Hilaria Supawamán, que es del Parlamento Congresista del Perú y vicepresidente del Parlamento Indígena de América. Señora Hilaria Supa, tiene usted la palabra. Así.
Tukuy son Coimanta, ñapayuque presidenta, Lio País Cunamanta, indígena Masí Conatapas, ñapayune, Chay Furun indígena permanente en Escazutiurta, y Willari Sartag, presidente, y Mainas, no canchispa causa ininchi, sajay, yachta kunapi, chaita, presidente. Quiero decir, presidente, a todos los hermanos y hermanas del Foro Permanente, saludar de todos los países, como Quechua, y yo soy de Cusco. Y, presidente, en estos instantes el cambio climático, el derecho de los pueblos indígenas y también el derecho de la madre tierra, porque no es de la tierra, sino es de nuestra madre, de la Pachamama, con este cambio climático, lo que está pasando en los pueblos más olvidados, más indefensos en todo el mundo, este cambio climático lo que está afectando. Las inversiones privadas capitalistas no lo están tomando en cuenta sobre el derecho de la tierra, la existencia de la tierra, porque la tierra, la madre, es lo que nos da alimentación, porque da frutos para alimentarnos. La madre tierra es lo que da agua, aire, para poder existir la humanidad. Y pero el ser, los capitalistas, ¿qué es lo que están haciendo? Contaminar y matar a la madre tierra. Y de paso, matando a la madre tierra, también está matando a sus habitantes, que es los pueblos indígenas, en la madre tierra, donde que siempre han defendido por miles de años. Presidente, por lo tanto, yo vengo 3 años aquí a este foro, y el foro ha sacado la declaración de los pueblos indígenas, los derechos, pero hasta hoy los países no lo están tomando en cuenta. Entonces, quiero decir que en este foro, o en este año, el 2010, quisiera preguntarle y decirle, plantearle también que el foro, presidente, pueda ser más, más efectivo para los países, para que puedan aplicar la declaración de la ONU. También en muchos países hay proyecto de ley, por ejemplo, como en el país, como en el Perú, como en Colombia y otros, la persecución de los dirigentes, cuando empiecen a defender la tierra, empiecen a defender tierra y territorio, el agua, no contaminación al agua, no contaminación al aire, realmente, ¿qué es lo que reciben? Reciben, es la cárcel, reciben muerte, porque ustedes saben, el mundo sabe, el año pasado nosotros, las organizaciones, también pidieron, gracias a que vaya el hermano del foro permanente Yenes Anaya, recomendó que Yenes Anaya recomendó al Perú para que esta mesas de diálogo que se estaba formándose después de Bagua, que fuera de las organizaciones de países que fueran como personas observadoras, pero sin embargo no entendió esta recomendación el gobierno y no lo tomó en cuenta. No hay organizaciones observadoras en esta mesa de diálogo. Por eso sale 2 informes, uno del Estado y uno de la organización de AIDZ. Entonces, presidente, lo que queremos es que realmente tomar en cuenta que unificarnos los pueblos indígenas para defender la vida, porque no solamente la tierra es para los pueblos indígenas, también es para todos los humanos, y el humano debe darse cuenta de no contaminar, debe tomar en cuenta la vida de los pueblos y la vida de la tierra, porque la tierra existe y los derechos de la tierra debemos respetar. Creo que el foro debe legislar o hacer recomendaciones sobre la tierra, sobre el derecho de la tierra, porque el derecho de la tierra es también el derecho de ser humano, el derecho de la madre, y el derecho de la madre es el derecho de la mujer. El que más sufren son las mujeres. ¿Por qué? Las mujeres indígenas son los que tienen que dar la alimentación y los que tienen que buscar un agua sana para poder dar a sus hijos. Igual la madre tierra también tiene que existir para producir, y para nosotros, cuando la tierra está muerta no hay producción, no va a haber alimentación. Esta es nuestra preocupación, presidente, y por lo tanto yo quisiera decir que este foro se puede pronunciar enérgicamente ante los países que realmente están afectados por este cambio climático en el Perú. Hemos sido en este año fuertemente afectados. Ha habido desbordes de ríos, ha habido deslizaciones de cerros y ha afectado viviendas, ha afectado mucha gente, se ha quedado sin viviendas. Entonces, es la causa de este cambio climático, presidente, por lo tanto, queremos que tomen en cuenta también los países que contaminan, como Estados Unidos, como otros países que son desarrollados supuestamente, que están contaminando y que también puedan dar indemnizaciones a los países como han acordado allí en Copenhague. Entonces, que se cumplan los acuerdos de Copenhague, presidente, y creo que el foro debe dar estas recomendaciones para que se cumpla el acuerdo de Copenhague y que firmen también los países que están contaminando, porque son los países desarrollados, son los que más contaminan al mundo, presidente. Muchísimas gracias.
Vamos a dar la palabra al siguiente orador de la lista, que es el señor... ¿Aquí? ¿Ya? A la señora María Sumire de Conde, que es congresista de la República del Perú. ¿Está la señora Sumire en sala? ¿Puede levantar la mano, señora Sumire? No. Entonces, vamos a proseguir con la exposición de los estudios que se han realizado. Vamos a pedir a nuestro colega Pavel Zuleanciga para que nos haga informe del reporte sobre el estudio de pueblos indígenas y corporaciones. Señor Zuleanciga, usted tiene la palabra. Sí, please. Tiene la palabra, señor Zuleanciga.
Спасибо, господин председатель, уважаемые коллеги, дорогие друзья. Я хотел бы представить свой отчет, который был поручен мне и моим коллегам из Латинской Америки, Карлос Мамани, и сделать этот отчет я хотел бы следующим образом. В ваших документах, в раздаточных материалах и на сайте постоянного форума есть мой отчет, он, правда, на русском языке. Я очень коротко хотел бы вас проинформировать о нем. Коренные малочисленные народы сегодня переживают очень сложный, а некоторые народы критический этап новейшей истории. С одной стороны, разрабатываются, реализуются широкомасштабные промышленные проекты практически во всех государствах, связанные в первую очередь с новым освоением природных ресурсов и обусловленные экономическим развитием. С другой стороны, идет небывалое колоссальное изъятие и сокращение территорий, священных мест, пастбищ, охотничьих и рыболовных участков коренных народов, которое, безусловно, оказывает негативное воздействие на экономическую, культурную и духовную жизнь народов. Для некоторых совсем малочисленных народов это создает реальную угрозу этническому существованию. Благополучие и будущее этих народов напрямую зависит от продуманной политики государства, международных институтов и организаций, от реализации политических и экономических прав коренных народов, подкрепленных мероприятиями по развитию их человеческого потенциала, укреплению традиционного хозяйства, защиты окружающей среды и правового регулирования отношений с недропользователями. Данный отчет может стать основой рассмотрения проблемы с точки зрения коренных народов, поможет международным институтам, государствам понять права и интересы коренных народов, их желаний к развитию. Актуальность этой проблематики не только сохраняется, а приобретает особое значение в связи с расширением географии и масштабов освоения природных ресурсов с одной стороны и нерешенностью вопросов, связанных с оценкой воздействия промышленного развития на коренные народы, формами и процедурами согласования интересов хозяйствующих субъектов и коренных народов с другой. При этом необходимо отметить, что доля транснациональных корпораций, компаний экономически развитых стран в добывающем секторе экономики стабильно увеличивается. Соответственно, усиливается и роль международных стандартов и практик, используемых и применяемых передовыми западными компаниями в области охраны окружающей среды, социальной ответственности и соблюдения прав коренных народов. Сравнительный анализ политики России, США, Канады, стран Скандинавии по присоединению северных земель и освоению их ресурсов показал, что на определенном этапе эта политика повсеместно трансформируется в политику доминирования и патернализма в отношении коренных народов и их ассимиляции. Такая политика сопровождается отчуждением коренных народов от своих территорий и ресурсов, потерей контроля над их использованием. Системным результатом такой политики становятся острые социальные проблемы коренных народов, экономическая и социальная апатия, потеря ценностных ориентиров, чувство безнадежности и бессмысленности жизни, алкоголизм, суициды. Социальные проблемы при этом превращаются в факторы, препятствующие включению коренных народов в проекты развития и повсеместно используются как доказательство объективности процесса ассимиляции и отсутствие альтернатив политике патернализма. Возникает замкнутый круг неблагополучия коренных народов, из которого не выбраться без изменения всех условий, которые определяют неблагополучие. Новые модели отношений с коренными народами получили развитие в начале 70-х годов 20-го столетия. За прошедший период коренные народы реализовали право на самоуправление в форме общественного управления территорией. Это, например, Гренландия, государство Дания, северный склон Аляски в Соединенных Штатах, Нунавут на севере Канады, а также аборигенного управления. В настоящее время становится очевидным, что будущее коренных народов зависит не только от сохранения условий для традиционного жизнеобеспечения и развития сопряженных отраслей хозяйства, и не просто от закрепления права собственности на леса и недра аборигенных земель. Как показывают передовые примеры канадского опыта, перемены к лучшему в общностях коренных народов происходят вместе с развитием сети аборигенных предприятий, которые эффективно используют обретенную собственность на природные ресурсы, работа которых на условиях аутсорсинга или в качестве партнера в акционерном капитале востребована компаниями. Поэтому важнейшим направлением политики Канады в отношении коренных народов является развитие человеческого потенциала аборигенных общин и развитие аборигенных предприятий. Острые проблемы неблагополучия коренных народов российского севера, связанные с экологическими издержками освоения минерально-сырьевых ресурсов, а также процессами отчуждения коренных народов от земель, ресурсов и управления промышленным развитием северных регионов, стали предметом активного осмысления и изучения в последние два десятилетия. В рамках общего реформирования политического и экономического курса Российской Федерации под влиянием политики зарубежных инвесторов, усиления социальной и экологической составляющей политики нефтегазовых регионов, укрепление имиджа крупных добывающих компаний, начало активно формироваться законодательство по правам коренных народов России. В ряде регионов, как Ханты-Мансийский и Ямал-Ненецкий автономные округа, происходят радикальные перемены в традиционных отраслях экономики. Уставами этих регионов обеспечено представительство коренных народов в органах исполнительной и законодательной власти. Здесь накоплен богатый опыт социального партнерства с промышленными компаниями, а также опыт государственного регулирования отношений между ними и владельцами родовых угодий. Согласно проведенным исследованиям организациями коренных народов, две российские компании ОАО «Новатек», работающая в сфере добычи и переработки газа в Ямал-Ненецком автономном округе, и акционерное общество «Тернелес», занимающееся переработкой леса в Приморском крае, уже сегодня работают по международным стандартам прав человека и прав коренных народов. Цель настоящего исследования состоит еще и в том, чтобы помочь коренным народам осознать и увидеть собственную перспективу, осуществить собственный выбор взаимоотношений с промышленными компаниями, работать совместно с государственными учреждениями и представителями бизнеса для получения тех выгод, которые связаны с реализацией промышленных проектов на территории их проживания. Для достижения поставленной цели я, как автор, выполнил следующие задачи. Дал обзор международных правовых стандартов по правам коренных народов и те ориентиры, которые они задают и которые необходимо иметь в виду при выработке новых подходов к освоению природных ресурсов. Обобщить принципы переговорного процесса для заключения соглашений с промышленными компаниями и реализации иных интересов коренных народов. Обобщить зарубежный опыт взаимоотношений коренных народов и корпораций, выделить передовой опыт, а также факторы и условия заключения этих успешных соглашений. Обозначить роль государства как гаранта прав коренных народов при урегулировании отношений с крупным бизнесом. Предложить основные элементы модели партнерских отношений между коренными народами и промышленными компаниями. Центральным политическим и экономическим событием новейшей истории коренных народов стало признание их прав на самоопределение, на владение и использование территории традиционного проживания и природопользования, участие в промышленном освоении ресурсов собственными приоритетами и стратегиями развития. В настоящее время получают распространение договоры с коренными народами как механизм реализации их прав. Анализ современной правовой базы зарубежного и российского опыта заключения соглашений с коренными народами позволяет обосновать следующие выводы. Первое. Декларация ООН по правам коренных народов, Конвенция МОД 169 и другие международные документы ориентируют государство на признание неотъемлемых прав коренных народов на земли, ресурсы и самоуправление и не ограничивают эти права сферами традиционного хозяйства и культуры. Они рекомендуют государствам сотрудничать с коренными народами и добросовестно проводить полные консультации до утверждения любого проекта, затрагивающего права и интересы коренных народов. Второе. В целом, пока не удалось решить проблему учета интересов коренных народов при освоении территорий в соответствии с распространенной мировой практикой и принятыми нормами международного права. Тем не менее, имеются удачные формы взаимоотношений недропользователей с владельцами родовых угодий, общинами коренных народов, а также представительными организациями этих народов, которые могут быть использованы как модельные. Третье. В ряде стран права коренных народов на землю признаны. Объем и содержание этих прав подробно определяется и вписывается в общую систему права и регулирования отношений в сфере использования земли и природных ресурсов. Правительства этих стран признают, что без развития человеческого потенциала коренные народы не могут воспользоваться своими правами и формировать свои стратегии развития. Поэтому правительственные структуры продолжают сотрудничать с коренными народами после заключения соглашений по их земельным притязаниям и самоуправлению. Они реализуют специальные программы в сфере образования, развития предпринимательства коренных народов в сопряженных с традиционной экономикой областях, таких как коммерческое рыболовство, туризм, лесной бизнес, недревесные продукты леса, в сфере инвестиций, услуг, строительства, транспорта, телекоммуникации, выполнение отдельных операций в добычных проектах. Ведущую роль государство играет при заключении соглашений между коренными народами и промышленными компаниями в случае планирования крупных проектов по добыче и переработке полезных ископаемых. Четвертое. Благодаря участию государства совершенствуются соглашения между коренными народами и промышленными компаниями. Их положения наполняются конкретным и ясным содержанием, приобретают характер правовых норм, обязательных для исполнения, а их исполнение сопровождается необходимой организационной и ресурсной поддержкой. Более полный учет интересов коренных народов в промышленных проектах открывает перед ними новые возможности и способствует повышению социально-экономических выгод общества в целом от освоения ресурсов территории. Пятое. В Российской Федерации, например, существует необходимость преодоления патерналистского отношения к коренным народам Севера, решение проблемы учета интересов коренных народов при освоении северных территорий в соответствии с распространенной мировой практикой и принятыми нормами международного права. Однако, как я уже говорил выше, существует уже определенная практика, в том числе и в нашей стране. Главный вопрос, который сегодня возникает в связи с переговорами между коренными народами и промышленными компаниями, в какой мере имеющиеся сегодня соглашения с промышленными компаниями отвечают интересам коренных народов? Тенденции последних лет показывают возрастающую динамику переговорного процесса и заключение соглашений между коренными народами и промышленными компаниями. Сравнение разных опытов заключения соглашений показывает, что в разных странах эти соглашения имеют разную роль и разные права. Например, в Канаде соглашения о выгодах местного населения работают в системе мероприятий, нацеленных на преодоление последствий политики патернализма. Среди них мероприятия в сфере здравоохранения, образования, профилактики алкоголизма и насилия в семье. Но ключевыми мерами, изменившими отношение людей к жизни, стали признание и реализация неотъемлемых прав коренных народов на землю, ресурсы и территориальное самоуправление. Соглашение становится частью этой системы мероприятий и поэтому реально способствует решению проблем неблагополучия, росту традиционной и новой экономик коренных народов и включению в процессы управления развитием. Опыт показывает, что самое главное для коренных народов не программы, не изобретение структур для решения отдельных проблем, не просто приобретение земельных прав и отдельных властных полномочий. Перемены совершают не структуры, а люди, поверившие, что справедливость и партнерство – не пустые слова, что они живут в обществе равных людей, что их будущее находится в собственных руках. И эта вера не как упование, а как видение лучшего будущего возникает не на почве обещаний и патернализма, а через признание государством несправедливости, допущенной в прошлом, справедливое разделение экономической и политической власти между коренными народами и доминирующим обществом. Соответствующие перемены становятся реальными только как результат совокупности взаимно поддерживающих друг друга мероприятий. При этом ключевыми являются меры по восстановлению коренных народов как нации, значительных групп людей, испытывающих разделяемое чувство национального самосознания, составляющих доминирующую часть населения определенной территории или ряда территорий, обретающих земельную и ресурсную базу для экономического развития и собственные институты власти, составляющие национально-территориальный уровень управления наряду с федеральным и региональным. Я очень кратко сообщил вам о тех исследованиях и том отчете, который я сегодня подготовил. Как я уже сказал, с этим отчетом вы можете ознакомиться. Он, к сожалению, представляет достаточно много страниц. И по моему мнению, как вы уже, наверное, знаете, мы на прошлых сессиях приняли решение об учреждении спецдокладчиков не одного, а трех человек по этой теме. Потому что данная тема является на сегодня очень важной и острой. Поэтому, как мне представляется очень важным, постоянному форуму необходимо продолжить эту работу в связи с тем, что по тем нашим докладам, которые мы и отчетам, которые мы представили и которые я представил, видно, что очень большая часть регионов нашей планеты, где проживают коренные народы, сегодня не охвачены этими исследованиями. И очень важно, чтобы эти исследования прошли ну, если не во всех, то во многих регионах, где проживают коренные народы. Как я уже в самом начале сказал, эта тема является очень острой и жизненно важной и необходимой для коренных народов. Спасибо.
Muchas gracias, señor Pavel Zulianziga. El fin de semana hemos tenido la oportunidad de ver una película y justamente la película, como había expresado al director Cameron, empieza mostrándonos una escena de una mina donde grandes máquinas explotan el territorio del pueblo indígena de la película, y esta es la realidad que vivimos hoy los pueblos indígenas. Y también es importante el anuncio que nos ha hecho nuestro colega Pavel respecto a la existencia de por lo menos dos empresas en Rusia que respetan los derechos de los pueblos indígenas y podrían ser ejemplos de buenas prácticas de cómo las corporaciones y los pueblos indígenas pueden de manera coordinada y en el respeto al derecho a la libre determinación, avanzar en la búsqueda de vías alternativas de desarrollo que no agredan a los territorios de los pueblos indígenas. Creo que, volviendo a la película, es importante siempre recordar la visión colonialista que la mayoría de las empresas transnacionales que operan en industrias extractivas tienen con los pueblos indígenas. No creo que podamos encontrar en el sur un solo caso de América del Sur, un solo caso de una empresa responsable con pueblos indígenas que haya respetado el derecho a la libre determinación y menos haya tenido las salvaguardas para no contaminar el medio ambiente, las aguas y los recursos vitales para los pueblos indígenas. Creo que, como dice Pavel, es un esfuerzo que debemos hacer por cubrir todo el espacio global donde habemos pueblos indígenas para ver cuál es la situación que los pueblos indígenas en general enfrentamos en relación a las corporaciones y particularmente, decía yo, respecto a las industrias extractivas. Entonces, se le agradece al colega Pavel por este estudio y vamos a hacer los esfuerzos ya para presentar un solo informe. Vamos a ahora dar paso a la lista de oradores. Pregunto otra vez si estará la señora María Sumire de Conde, que es congresista del Perú. Señora Conde, usted tiene la palabra. Como expresamos también, seamos generosos con el tiempo, porque hay un buen número de delegados que vienen de todo el mundo y que no han hecho el uso de la palabra, entonces vamos a acá trabajar con esta máquina que controla el tiempo, entonces por favor ruego que ustedes sean generosos en observar la lucecita roja que se enciende y cuando se encienda pues hemos terminado con la participación. Tiene la palabra la señora Conde.
Estimados hermanos y hermanas, les hago llegar el saludo en especial de los pueblos quechuas asentados en las altas cordilleras andinas del Perú. Nuestra Pachamama, en esta parte del hemisferio denominada el Perú, posee 117 zonas de vida del mundo, posee también 28 de los 32 tipos de clima del mundo, 25.000 especies de flora, 75.000 plantas endémicas, 4.400 plantas nativas utilizadas por la población y 128 plantas nativas domesticadas, 2.000 especies de peces marinos y continentales, 3.000 especies de orquídeas, acceso de 3 macrocuencas, Amazónica, Titicaca y Pacífico. Así como país rico en biodiversidad, también contamos con una riqueza cultural de la cual nos sentimos orgullosas. Existimos 72 nacionalidades y pueblos originarios indígenas, de las cuales 65 son nacionalidades amazónicas y 7 somos pueblos andinos distribuidos en 7.000 comunidades asentadas a lo largo de la cordillera. Como pueblos originarios, actualmente estamos enfrentando la presencia de la actividad extractiva de metales a partir del bon minero de la década de 1980. Hasta la actualidad, más de 17 mil millones de hectáreas de territorio nacional fueron otorgadas en concesión a empresas mineras, y el 55% de todas las comunidades campesinas en los Andes están concesionadas a la minería, iniciándose una actividad egoísta y respetuosa contra la madre naturaleza por hallar los preciados metales, destruyendo la Pachamama y contaminando los ríos. Con el afán de asegurar la concesión de las tierras y territorio de las comunidades y pueblos originarios, desde el gobierno se estructura un marco normativo que agrede los derechos consagrados de los pueblos originarios, respeto de la tierra, de la madre tierra, confronta las leyes peruanas con los tratados internacionales que respaldan este derecho y se provocan conflictos sociales. Se criminaliza la protesta ciudadana y se implementa una feroz persecución contra los dirigentes de las comunidades afectadas. En suma, se violan los derechos de los pueblos indígenas. Se incrementa la migración de las poblaciones andinas y amazónicas por efectos de la contaminación de los recursos naturales. Y finalmente se agreda a la naturaleza, a los ríos, a la fertilidad de la madre tierra, a los nevados, a la salud de los pueblos originarios, principalmente guardianes de nuestra riqueza natural. En el Perú, el 11.80% de las actividades mineras se ubican en poblaciones de extrema pobreza y el 40.20% en poblaciones pobres. Los pueblos originarios, que suman unos 45 millones de personas. Por ello, hermanos, hay que fortalecer las acciones a emprender con aquellos sectores de la sociedad que luchan contra los orígenes y efectos del cambio climático. Monitorear en los países con mayor contaminación ambiental y en aquellos donde se conserva la biodiversidad, los niveles de contaminación, el marco normativo existente, y se posibilitan acuerdos para emprender reformas y armonizar estas políticas con la cosmovisión de los pueblos originarios. Muchas gracias, Uspalay.
A usted, señora congresista, vamos a abrir la lista de oradores a los caucus. Y el siguiente orador es el señor Pi Isu, del Caucus Mundial de Jóvenes. Señor Pi Isu, tiene la palabra. O señorita Pi Isu, disculpe.
Thank you for making Youth Caucus part of the planning for future work of the Permanent Forum. We would like to hereby address a couple emerging issues pertinent to indigenous youth. Economic sovereignty is the key to the overall sovereignty of our people. The recent global economic crisis has worsened the poverty condition and livelihood of our family. Indigenous youth workers are forced to work longer hours and to sustain income. This has threatened our right to education and equal opportunities. By educating the youth, we can grow stronger as an indigenous community. Education is the fundamental right for indigenous youth. However, not all indigenous youth have equal access to education designed for our need in our language and reflects our worldview. We shall put priority on revitalizing our language and our culture. Mr. Chairman, climate change is another pressing issue which endanger the livelihood of our family. With increased exposure to natural disasters, our people are becoming climate victims. We are forced to relocation and dispossession of our lands. Our culture is uprooted from our traditional territories. Mr. Chairman, it has also come to our attention that not some of our indigenous brothers and sisters do not have equal access to the permanent forum. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People reaffirms that we, the indigenous people, should be free from discrimination of any kind when we are exercising our rights. Indigenous youth especially should have equal rights to attend the permanent forum and learn from the forefront of indigenous works. Recommendations. First, we urge the Permanent Forum to review problems of poverty and land rights and to reassure that developments are not at the cost of indigenous peoples. We urge governments to stop forced relocation and grant legal recognition to the ownership and control over our customary lands and resources. Second, we highly recommend that the permanent forum work closely with UNICEF and other UN agencies to empower future indigenous leaders. Third, we request action plans and strategies to be discussed in the permanent forum for the reduction of education gap between indigenous and non-indigenous. We want an education that will end discrimination against the indigenous people and promote respect of our culture. Fourth, grant access to the permanent forum based on our indigenous nation, rather on states, and restore the mislabeled indigenous youth whose bloodline is mixed due to colonization. And last but not least, that all government should have legal system to protect and represent indigenous people. In 2007, the Vietnamese government arrested, defrocked, and imprisoned these three former Kuma Krom monks who are standing behind us today. We recommend that governments, especially the Vietnamese government, respect the freedom of religion and have legal system to protect victimized people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to warmly thank the representative of the Youth Caucus for their excellent statement, and to remind you that the youth voice here at the Permanent Forum is a critical voice and that we take your voice very, very seriously and look forward to reviewing your recommendations very closely. Thank you very much. I would like to call the next speaker on our list, Jethro Tullian, from the Pacific Caucus. Sir, you're in the room. Mr. Tullian, you have the floor.
Okay. Intervention of the Pacific Caucus, item number 7. Madam Chairperson, this intervention is presented on behalf of the Pacific Caucus regarding the future work of the Permanent Forum. Indigenous peoples and corporations. Indigenous communities in Australia, Papua New Guinea, New Zealand, Vanuatu and Kanaki, New Caledonia, under increasing pressure from states and the extractive units to gain access to traditional lands, particularly in resource regions. Traditional owners must be engaged in all decisions which are based on free, prior and informed consent. We call on the Permanent Forum to urge all states to appoint a commission for social responsibility to develop standards in relation to the extractive industry, including standards that mitigate as well as possibly the negative impacts of resource projects on local communities. Indigenous communities have spiritual and customary association with fisheries resources. However, there is no comprehensive recognition of fishing rights in many parts of the Pacific. National recognition is a priority and concessions must be made to address unreasonable and restrictive licensing regimes imposed by many states. States such as Australia, France, Chile, and the U.S. must formally implement and give prior meaning to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as it applies to Pacific nations. Report on Indigenous Peoples and Boarding Schools. As human rights are universal and indivisible, Indigenous young people should not forego their rights to self-determination and cultural integrity to realize their right to education. Indigenous peoples must always, as a first option, be able to assess the highest standard of education in their homelands. The impact of policies assimilation on Indigenous youths must be recognized, and all education policies must be consistent with Article 14 of the Declaration, which emphasizes the importance of education and culture to Indigenous peoples. States in the Pacific must distribute educational resources equitably and provide adequate financial support for education of Indigenous peoples of culture, tradition, and education in their languages, including higher education. We recommend that states develop national benchmarks on educational standards to monitor effectiveness, taking into account the importance and diversity of Indigenous peoples' culture and generally in educational experience. We further recommend that states use and develop technology and distance education to enable Indigenous peoples in remote areas to receive excellent education in their homeland. Rising sea levels associated with climate change threatens many islands in the Pacific region and threatening supplies of fresh drinking water. In repatriation of traditional country due to submission of inundation will have a detrimental effect on the health and well-being of indigenous peoples. The Anchorage Declaration represents the position of the world's indigenous people and should be acknowledged and supported by all states. Any climate change schemes must recognize the rights of indigenous peoples and must uphold right to full and effective participation in its development and implementation. Decisions should be based on free, prior and informed consensus and the potential contribution of indigenous people towards resolving the climate change crisis must be acknowledged. Preliminary study on the impact of indigenous peoples of the indigenous international constructive known as the doctrine of discovery, which has served as the foundation of the violation of their human rights. The doctrine of discovery is akin to the doctrine of terra naturalis applied in Australia. Both have a history of entrenched racism and genocide and have been used to rationalize the deportation of indigenous peoples from their lands and water and to justify non-recognition of their political sovereignty. We recommend that the Permanent Forum undertake a comprehensive review of the doctrine of discovery and the terra naturalis with regard to indigenous peoples' inherent right as recognized in the Declaration on the Right of Indigenous Peoples. Key findings and recommendations should be submitted to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in 2012. Support of the expert group meeting on Indigenous youth and children in detention. The human rights and fundamental freedom of children and youth in the Pacific are severely threatened by alarming high rate of incarceration and continued rise. Incarceration removes our children from their land and culture and impacts their health, well-being and growth. We argue the Permanent Forum to require all states to divert Indigenous children and youth away from detention and custody as a matter of priority, using detention as a matter of last resort. Divisionary programs should be developed and facilitated in partnership with Indigenous peoples and organizations. We further argue the Permanent Forum identify mechanisms to increase accessibility and participation of Indigenous children and youth in the UN system. Discussion on Indigenous people and forests. In the Pacific, on islands, forests are an integral part of Indigenous life. For these in lower-lying regions and atolls, the coral in the waters are our forests and eagerly need protection. The forests are rich source of our culture, economy, and are occupied and used for food, medical, spiritual, cultural, social, and economic purposes. Unsustainable logging, poor water management, urban spirals, mining, and other development endanger our forests. We ask the Permanent Forum to argue states to fully protect Indigenous knowledge and culture heritage within forests by fully adopting the AquaCon guidelines and encourage the participation of Indigenous peoples in monitoring and reporting, including Ramsar sites and other sites of international significance. We further recommend that the state use and develop technology and distance. Further, all states should reduce sustainable logging and extraction activities, as well as water management and right to free, fair, and informed consensus must be available. Relocation of the permanent forum, Madam said last one. Finally, we recommend the permanent forum move between the regions annually to allow fair and equitable access to mechanisms. While the renovation continues at the UN building in New York with success, the Permanent Forum considers relocating to Bangkok to increase the potential for participation by Pacific delegates who should otherwise be unable to offer to attend the forum. To facilitate the relocation, we recommend the forum train interpreters based on all regions to standards required by the United Nations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Talian, for your excellent report, and I'd like to also thank you for your close scrutiny of all of the different reports that have come out of this meeting. Certainly, you look very closely at the expert group meeting on Indigenous children in custody, the preliminary study on the doctrine of discovery, and all of the other reports. It's a lot of work, and on behalf of myself and the other members of the Permanent Forum, we thank you for your good work. The next person on my list is the representative of the Australian Caucus, and I'd like to recognize Ms. Sandra Creamer. Ms. Creamer, are you in the room, please?
Please raise your hand.
Oh, Mr. Creamer, a gentleman is going to be speaking on behalf of the Australian Caucus. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm deputising for Ms. Creamer, who is taken ill. My name is Neil Gillespie, and this intervention is presented on behalf of the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia present at this forum. The human rights and fundamental freedoms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and youth in Australia and Indigenous children and youth around the world are severely threatened by alarmingly high rates of incarceration that are continuing to rise. Indigenous children and youth often face disadvantage and marginalisation from birth until adulthood and is characterised by intergenerational poverty, overcrowding in poor housing conditions, low levels of literacy and numeracy, low quality of health and well-being and life expectancy, welfare dependency, social marginalisation, poor and unsuitable service delivery by governments, inadequate resources, funding and support for culturally appropriate Indigenous-owned and controlled services, and finally, over-policing, targeting and discrimination by police and law enforcement agencies. Programs need to address these multifaceted and interrelated considerations to overcome disadvantage, marginalisation and the structural impediments and barriers to justice systems that all impact on the high involvement of Indigenous children and youth in detention and custody. A particular framework proving successful in mainstream communities in the United States of America and the United Kingdom is justice reinvestment, which is a localised criminal justice policy approach diverting a portion of funds for imprisonment to local communities where there is a high concentration of offenders. Justice reinvestment was recently recommended by the departing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner of Australia and is supported by the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia present at this forum. Our recommendations are, Madam Chair, that the Permanent Forum urge states to divert Indigenous children and youth away from detention and custody as a matter of priority, using detention only as a matter of last resort. That the Permanent Forum urge states to engage and consult with Indigenous peoples and organisations to identify causal factors and strategies to overcome the disproportionately high level of involvement and over-representation by Indigenous children and youth in the justice system. Thirdly, that the Permanent Forum urge states to provide resources to empower Indigenous organisations where possible to implement culturally appropriate programs that prevent, intervene, divert and rehabilitate Indigenous youth in the justice system through counselling, mediation, employment, education and cultural and family reconnections. The Permanent Forum should encourage discussion and input from states and Indigenous peoples and organisations about best practice models such as justice reinvestment and consider how to encourage a framework for broader application beyond local settings. And finally, Madam Chair, we urge that the Permanent Forum work to identify mechanisms for increasing accessibility and participation for Indigenous children and youth in the UN system to highlight their issues and concerns directly with the international community, including consideration of an international complaints mechanism. Finally, Madam Chair, please note that a more comprehensive report on these issues has been provided to the Permanent Forum for its consideration. I thank you.
I'd like to thank Mr. Neil Gillespie for your very good presentation and your excellent recommendations on Indigenous children. We look forward to giving a close scrutiny to many of your recommendations. So thank you, sir. The next speaker on the list from the region of Russia and representing the Youth Association of Finno-Ugric Peoples is Mr. Alexei Zikrev. Mr. Alexei Zikrev, are you in the room, sir?
Yeah, he is. He's over there.
Great. You have the floor, sir.
Уважаемая госпожа председатель, уважаемые эксперты и участники заседания форума, международное движение финно-угорских народов выражает благодарность форуму за значительные успехи в деле защиты прав коренных народов и участие в разработке и принятии декларации прав коренных народов. Финно-угорские народы, уже 20 лет объединенные в единое движение, выступают за то, чтобы именно эта декларация играла решающую роль в строительстве национальной и региональной политики государств. Мы признаем значительные успехи и увеличение государственной поддержки коренных финно-угорских народов. Однако с тревогой отмечаем, что несмотря на то, что Россия признает все народы коренными, большее внимание уделяется, тем не менее, коренным малочисленным народам, численность которых менее 50 тысяч человек. Это ограничение уменьшает возможности более масштабной государственной поддержки всех коренных народов страны. На своих форумах финно-угорские народы всегда отмечают, что принципы определения коренных народов, взятые за основу международным сообществом и декларации прав коренных народов, больше отвечают нашим интересам. Также отмечаем, что несмотря на отсутствие формальных запретов собрания представителей коренных народов, в законодательстве продолжает отсутствовать понятие «съезд народа». Представительство коренных народов в органах власти регионов компактного проживания остается незначительным. Это, безусловно, отрезает коренные народы от непосредственного демократического участия в процессе определения приоритетов социально-экономического развития. Безусловно, для финно-угорских народов России основным вопросом повестки дня продолжает оставаться сохранение и развитие языка и культуры. Вызывают тревогу данные ученых о том, что среди представителей некоторых финно-угорских народов менее половины владеет родным языком, а естественная передача языка из поколения в поколение почти приостановилась. Такие языки по классификации ЮНЕСКО находятся в очень сложной ситуации. Большие надежды связаны с внедрением методики языкового гнезда, когда в течение всего дня с детьми дошкольного учреждения образования говорят только на языке национального меньшинства. Мы призываем государство соблюдать на практике законы, гарантирующие образование на родном языке. Гораздо лучше обстоят дела в области культуры финно-угорских народов. Их право на удовлетворение культурных потребностей осуществляется. Однако кризис в экономике последних лет заставляет власти экономить на сельской культурной инфраструктуре и применять к развитию профессионального искусства арифметический подход. Так, успешность профессионального национального театра может измеряться не качеством постановок на языке коренного народа, а количеством заработанных денег. Такой подход неприемлем, когда речь идет о культуре не массовой, а культуре коренного народа. Финно-угорские народы считают перспективной работу по охране памятников нематериального культурного наследия. Страны, которые не ратифицировали Конвенцию о защите памятников нематериального наследия ЮНЕСКО, могут разрабатывать отечественные списки памятников культуры, применяя стандарты и описательные механизмы ЮНЕСКО. Однако финно-угорские народы призывают государство рассматривать вопрос о присоединении к этой конвенции. И предлагаем форуму коренных народов взять этот вопрос на заметку. Данная конвенция позволит, безусловно, сохранять наследие коренных народов от пагубного влияния, в том числе корпораций и бизнеса. На наш взгляд, существуют определенные сложности в области природопользования. Сегодня законы об охоте и рыболовстве в некоторых субъектах Российской Федерации таковы, что общины коренных народов должны чуть ли не покупать квоты на вылов рыбы и ведение промысла. Мы считаем, что национальное законодательство, даже если страна не присоединилась к конвенции, должно учитывать права всех коренных народов, вне зависимости от их численности. В области лесопользования в России дела обстоят, безусловно, лучше благодаря инструменту сертификации и разработанных стандартов лесопользования. Держатели сертификата, компании, которые имеют сертификат, например, FSC, Лесного попечительского совета, обязаны вести консультации и учитывать мнение коренных народов при определении участков на вырубке леса. Призываем постоянный форум изучить этот опыт и содействовать распространению лесной сертификации. На последнем, в 5-м Всемирном конгрессе финно-угорских народов в Ханты-Мансийске присутствовали президенты 4 стран – России, Венгрии, Финляндии и Эстонии. Это говорит о большом внимании со стороны государств к проблемам коренных народов этих стран. Мы рассчитываем на дальнейший плодотворный диалог коренных народов, государств, НПО, бизнеса и, конечно, молодежи. Спасибо за внимание.
Yeah. I'd like to thank you for your contribution to this discussion. Thank you very much, sir. And I'd like to call on Mr. Jean-Georges Bidard from the Trade Union Gerebid Ekatria from the Europe region of France. I see you, and you have the floor, sir.
Yes. Egunon bertatutako guziei. Salutations à tous les représentants de l'instance permanente et au peuple représenté à l'occasion de cette précieuse rencontre. Nous parlons au nom de l'organisation Garabide et Trait d'Union du peuple basque de l'Europe occidentale. Parler de développement intégral dans le contexte des peuples originaires signifie mettre en exergue une question fondamentale. Le développement intégral des peuples commence dans la mesure où il y a une expérience collective, un capital social de l'expérience identitaire. Les langues et les cultures originaires constituent l'un des fondements de l'identité et par conséquent l'un des axes fondamentaux du développement communautaire. Lorsque les langues disparaissent, les peuples disparaissent également. Le peuple basque est considéré comme l'un des plus anciens peuples originaires d'Europe occidentale et conserve l'une des langues les plus anciennes au monde, l'euskara, qui perdure depuis des millénaires, malgré diverses conquêtes et discriminations à travers les siècles. Quoique le Pays basque jouisse d'un niveau de développement économique élevé, nous croyons que notre plein développement en tant que peuple se réalisera uniquement si nous sommes capables de maintenir notre essence, notre être, notre identité et notre langue. À quoi sert le développement économique si nous cessons d'être ce que nous avons été pendant des milliers d'années? L'euskara, cette langue si ancienne, petite mais modernisée, est le patrimoine de toute l'humanité et constitue le cœur de notre culture, le cœur de notre peuple. Quoique nous subissions encore une discrimination et déplorions le manque de statut officiel sur certains territoires, et notamment le territoire français, il y a eu, au cours des 40 dernières années, dans des régions au sud du Pays basque, une renaissance, une lutte basée sur la volonté de la société civile en faveur de l'identité. Aujourd'hui, nous avons des écoles et des universités dans notre langue originaire, des organisations de développement culturel, des chaînes de télévision en langue originaire, des stratégies pour avoir une présence sur Internet. Notre culture s'épanouit à la fois en tant que culture ancienne et moderne, au carrefour où le préhistorique et le post-moderne se rencontrent pour rêver de l'avenir. Mais c'est un travail en cours, et nous ne pouvons pas encore crier victoire. Notre langue est toujours une langue en danger, et nous nous préparons au branle-bas de combat. Mais en plus de parler de notre peuple, nous voulons aujourd'hui vous faire part des points suivants. Premièrement, un message d'alarme selon l'UNESCO, la majorité des langues parlées par les représentants présents dans cette salle, bien qu'elles soient très importantes, disparaîtront un jour. Lorsqu'une langue disparaît, c'est aussi une langue et un peuple qui disparaissent. Il nous faut des diagnostics adéquats. Les langues autochtones sont gravement malades et si nous n'établissons pas de diagnostics rigoureux, elles se dirigeront vers une mort certaine. Le deuxième message est un message d'espoir. Il est possible de faire épanouir une langue, une culture, tout comme il est possible de faire en sorte que nos cultures ancestrales soient protégées dans les siècles à venir. Troisièmement, nous vous transmettons un message de responsabilité. Les droits sont importants, mais il ne suffit pas de revendiquer des droits auprès des gouvernements et des instances internationales. Les peuples eux-mêmes ont la responsabilité de créer des stratégies pour permettre l'épanouissement de leur langue et de leur culture. C'est le seul moyen de survivre et de se développer intégralement. Nous voulons vous faire part de ce que nous avons appris lors de cette floraison de la langue basque au cours des 40 dernières années avec les apprentissages des autres peuples originaires. Nous avons créé l'organisation Garabide pour partager l'expérience basque et nous vous invitons à nous contacter pour que nous puissions élaborer ensemble des stratégies concrètes pour la récupération des langues et des cultures. Et nous voulions terminer avec une recommandation à l'instance permanente que nous réfléchissions plus profondément.
Mr. Bidar, please make your closing remarks. Your time is up. Please make your closing remarks. Thank you.
Très bien. Merci à vous.
Thank you very much, sir.
Oui. Oui, on va la photocopier.
Ethiopia, okay. Thank you very much, sir. The next speaker on our list is Sandra Nelson Zongo. She represents the Ethiopian World Federation of Ethiopia. Ms. Zongo, are you in the room?
Please raise the hand if you want.
Please raise your hand if you're in the room. Sandra Nelson Zongo? No, let me move to the next speaker on the list, please. Ivan Toring of the Asia Pacific Youth Network.
Yeah, he's here.
Over on the side. Ivan, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Ay kanan kanu di ulalim we enta kuman kabla awan nanada ay amam ayat inin a isna ay pagilian. To all the members of the United Nations, all state representatives, distinguished guests, indigenous organizations, and participants, good day to all of you. I am Ivan Torafing, an Igorot from Cordillera, Philippines. This is a statement of the Asia-Pacific Indigenous Youth Network. Once again, thank you, Madam Chairperson, for giving me the chance to present this statement in connection to the expert group meeting on Indigenous youth and children in detention. This opportunity is highly significant to voice out the situations and problems confronting youth and children in Indigenous communities. Furthermore, to challenge each and every one of us, especially the Permanent Forum and the concerned agencies and Indigenous organizations, to take action on these problems. Madam Chair, let me draw your attention to the increasing number of Indigenous youth in detention centers and in prison. In many conflict-prone situations in Asia, Indigenous youth continues to be subjected to emergency legislations and national security laws, where their fundamental rights continues to be violated with impunity. International policy advancements on children and youth continue to be inapplicable and unimplemented in many of the conflict-afflicted Indigenous peoples' territories in Asia. Madam Chair, all of us become a child and youth once in our lives, and I believe that everybody do not want any youth and children suffer violence. For the interest of all Indigenous youth and children and their communities, these are our recommendations. We call on this permanent forum to urge all states and governments to ratify and implement all human rights treaties, particularly the Convention on the Rights of the Child, Convention Against Torture, and International Convention on Civil and Political Rights for full protection of human rights of Indigenous youth and children. We call upon all member states of United Nations to ensure full implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, particularly the right to self-determination. By doing so, we hope for the full protection of our land and resources, which defines Indigenous peoples' culture and identity. Without it, the children and youth of any Indigenous group were not able to live with their culture and tradition. We call on the UNPFII, Special Rapporteur, all states and other human rights bodies to take initiative to end the violence against youth and children. Also to secure the rights of indigenous peoples to fight for their rights, especially the youth that are arrested, accused of collaborating with secessionist groups in the struggle to defend land and resources. We would like to call on states for recognition of full participation and proper presentation of indigenous peoples in decision-making processes regarding policies for rehabilitation of indigenous youth in prisons and juvenile justice protection. In particular, the youth and children should be given the chance to participate in defining the programs that would address their needs. We call on the UNICEF to conduct independent studies and analysis of the situations of indigenous youth imprisoned in different indigenous countries and the continuing human rights violations. We call on all UN agencies to support the indigenous peoples' organizations and human rights organizations to conduct studies and researches on indigenous communities regarding imprisoned indigenous youth and children. We urge all states and governments to implement child-friendly legislations with due participation of indigenous peoples. Furthermore, to ensure greater protection and proper treatment to indigenous children and youth while in prison and in detention centers, and to provide them with socio-educational measures for their rehabilitation. We call on the international funding agencies and governments to provide support on indigenous communities to avoid children and youth engaging in petty crimes because of extreme poverty. Moreover, to provide funding for the youth-initiated activities and projects and also to support indigenous youth participation and involvement in the future sessions of United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and other related events concerning indigenous populations. It is an honor to participate in this gathering to convey the voices of children and youth in detention. We hope that the voice of children and youth in this permanent forum will be heard and addressed. Agbyag dagiti na insigudan nga umili, long live the indigenous peoples of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torfing, for your well-presented intervention today. We do appreciate it. I would like to ask the Kauani Foundation from the Pacific region if they are ready to present their intervention.
Madam Chair, there's been a mix-up and a change, a correction. Actually, the presentation will be by Kenneth Deere on behalf of the Indigenous World Association.
That's fine. Just one moment, please. And that does include your foundation, so it's a joint statement. Is that correct?
Actually, it's a collective statement. Yeah. Pardon me?
On behalf of which organization?
Yeah.
Okay.
On behalf of which organization?
I don't know.
Okay. So for our records, we need to know if this is a joint statement, number one, and who are the organizations that are part of the joint statement, number two. So before I give the floor to Kenneth Deere. So if you could do that, please.
Okay, the this is a collective intervention, and it's given by Indigenous World Association, which is ECOSOC, on behalf of Nakoi Kaika o Kalahui, Hawaii, the Kauani Foundation, Ole Sio Siomaga Society Incorporated, Samoa, Kaupuni o Hawaii, Keata Tino Toa, Guahan Coalition for Peace and Justice, Guahan Indigenous Collective, Inatan Gef Pago, Famoka Sayan, and the National Association of Social Workers, Guam Chapter 1, Nacion Chamorro. Yes, I made the change this morning, but I understand that it was already printed, so. But you can see Indigenous World Association was originally a part of it, and Kenneth Deere is the speaker on that part. If there's no issue.
Okay. Well, apparently we have a little confusion in terms of the procedure with the secretariat, but we can straighten that out at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So if Kenneth and the both of you come up to the podium, and we'll clear that up. I'm sure it's just a minor confusion. So
sure.
I apologize for that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We do too.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime.
So continuing with the speakers list in terms of Indigenous Peoples and Corporations, I'd like to call on Dennis Eggington from the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Sir, are you in the room?
Yes.
Oh, very good.
It's not Dennis.
Madam?
It's
and if you would introduce yourself, please.
Did you hear what she said?
Introduce Madam, you yourself. Have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sandy Miller. I'm speaking instead of Mr. Eglinton. Indigenous communities in Australia are under increasing pressure from states and industry, more so extractive industries, to gain access to traditional lands, particularly in resource-rich regions. With economic development and in particular heavy mining activities comes the need for increased corporate social responsibility protections and initiatives. Some major companies in Australia are setting high standards for maintaining a good corporate citizen reputation. However, many others are not. Indigenous peoples in Australia note the move by the Canadian state to appoint a corporate social responsibility councillor with a specific mandate to review the corporate social responsibility practices of Canadian extractive sector companies operating outside Canada. This is a positive initiative. While some corporations in the extractive industry offers limited benefits to Indigenous communities by way of employment, training and business development, there are a large number that see the native title component of the Australian approvals process as a mere box-ticking exercise. This means that rather than engage fully and effectively with traditional owners about exercise to land, they merely undertake the minimal compliance necessary to satisfy bureaucratic red tape. It is incumbent on the states like Australia to encourage and expect communities to meet high standards of corporate social responsibility. There are many resource projects already underway in Australia which have a downflow effect for other small businesses, and many more are in the planning and construction phases. This will mean increased expectations on more timely and trouble-free access to land, bringing both tribulations as well as potential economic benefits to traditional owners. It is imperative that these industries maintain high standards in dealing with communities. Corporate social responsibility is about mitigating as much as possible the negative impacts of development projects on local communities, and this includes engaging with local communities, particularly traditional owners. Engagement with traditional owners and free, prior and informed consent should form part of the development process. The key to social responsibility is engagement and being inclusive of Indigenous people's needs and aspirations, as well as recognising their own social, economic and cultural responsibilities for community and caring for country. Traditional owners in Australia call on the state of Australia to develop accountability systems on industry best practice for the highest standards to ensure maximum corporate social responsibility standards are developed and maintained by not only the extractive industries but also other areas as well. This position should also ensure the same standards are maintained by Australian industry companies, particularly extractive industries operating outside Australia. And our recommendation, Madam Chair, is that the Permanent Forum develop a mechanism on corporate social responsibility within the United Nations framework that meets human rights standards to encourage states to implement and protect the social, economic and cultural rights of Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much for your presentation and your excellent recommendation. Thank you, Madam. I would like to ask and invite the distinguished representative from the country of Vietnam to speak. Sir, Madam, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, for giving me the floor. And I'd like to speak in response to the statement made earlier by Youth Caucus. First, I am obliged to express our opposition to what Youth Caucus said at the end of their statement about our government's policy, because we believe that it's based on totally fabricated and groundless information about our government's policy. And second, I'd like to suggest, Madam Chairperson, to remind delegates to focus on the topic we are discussing under this agenda item in the interest of the forum. And we do hope that delegates will use the floor to address real issues of Indigenous people and not for their political motivation. I thank you, Madam Chairperson.
I'd like to thank the distinguished representative from the government of Vietnam for her statement and also her reminding us to stay within the agenda item and topic of our agenda. Thank you, Madam, for your intervention. This afternoon, I would like to announce that the Permanent Forum will continue its consideration of Agenda Item 7 in accordance with the program of work as contained in the document and the proposal of work that you have. The meeting of the forum will take place in this conference room 1, and we will be reconvening at 3 o'clock. And the Secretariat has a few announcements, so if you will give her your kind attention, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just one announcement that tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning, there will be a meeting of Global Indigenous Caucus in this very room, NLB 1, at 8:30 in the morning. Thank you.
We will be adjourned until 3 o'clock. Everyone have a good afternoon. Thank you.